Hello and welcome to another episode of All for Nature. I'm your host, Michelle Bonebreak, and I'm an outdoor educator here at Shaw Nature Reserve. Okay, listeners, welcome to the final installment of our three-part series about ecological gardening. If you haven't listened to the first two episodes in our series, I recommend you listen to those first, because those episodes really lay the groundwork for this final piece. If you're all caught up, hopefully you're feeling more comfortable about the idea of gardening in a way that supports our neighbors in the natural world. But there's one more piece of developing a native garden that we should explore, and we'll do that today. Once again, we welcome back Vivian Baus, a member of our horticulture team, to help us understand how to maintain our gardens and keep them looking beautiful all year long. And don't forget, after the interview, keep listening for updates about upcoming events at the Nature Reserve. But now, let's bat clean up in this series with Ecological Gardening 101, Part 3, Maintenance and Cleanup. Welcome back, Vivian, and thank you for joining us again. So most of our listeners probably remember you from the last two episodes, but just in case, just tell us who you are and what you do.
Sure thing. So I'm a horticulturist at Shaw Nature Reserve, and my background's in ecological restoration. I've had experience in native landscaping, public education, and land management. I joined the restoration crew at Shaw in 2021, and then in 2022, I transitioned to the horticulture team. Our team manages the Whitmire Wildflower Garden, which is an educational display garden that showcases our region's native plants and natural landscapes. In addition to managing this diverse garden, we also get to work on so many other tasks, like growing native plants, seed collection, designing new plantings, public education and outreach programs and classes. It's pretty amazing, especially considering that I still get to practice my restoration roots while exploring my passions for native plant horticulture and public education and outreach.
Nice. Okay, so this is our third episode of our three-part series on ecological gardening. And so far, we've learned a lot, thanks to you, about why it's so important for us to include native plants in our gardens. And we've talked about how to plan and design our gardens. Listeners, if you haven't yet heard those episodes, now would probably be a good time to pause here and go back and listen, because Vivian did an amazing job helping us understand more in part one about why it's so very important to consider and incorporate native plants into our home landscapes, and in part two about how to go about designing our native gardens in a way that works best for us, for our neighbors, and critically for the wildlife that calls our native ecosystems home. If you have already heard parts one and two, welcome to part three, where we will be discussing ways to care for and maintain our new native gardens and keep them looking beautiful all season long and all year long. Let's fast forward now to late spring. Let's say it's mid-May. The weather is warm. We've established a nice, comfortable place for our native plants to grow. We've gone out to the spring wildflower market at Shaw Nature Reserve, of course, and picked up the right plants for our space, and we've put our little baby plants in the ground. Let's start there, Vivian. What are some things we can do to support our new plants and give them the best start?
So once you've planted your new little babies, you could add a thin layer of leaf mulch, about 1 to 2 inches thick, and then give that new planting a good soaking. I like to water new plantings daily for about a week, and if it's especially dry that season, make sure to water at least once a week. Sprinklers are best for ensuring a good, thorough soaking. That initial mulching is the only time mulch needs to be added. The goal is to use that first layer of mulch as a weed suppressor while the plants fill in. This should ideally eliminate the need for mulch, as your plants are growing so densely and act as living mulch. Additional plants can be added later to fill in as necessary. So that thin layer of mulch, about 1 or 2 inches, will go a long way towards preventing weed germination, retaining moisture in the soil, and supporting moderate soil temperatures. As it decays, it adds beneficial nutrients to soil. However, I do have to rant about mulch. It's something that seems to have this power of mind control over otherwise sensible folk. I mean, each year we spend an estimated $1 billion to cover soil with mulch.
Wow.
It's one of those things that we have ingrained in us as a necessity and the norm. Ecological gardening is all about examining these norms and asking ourselves, why do we do it? Is there a better alternative? The best alternative is a garden that mimics nature, with densely planted plants that eliminate the need for mulch entirely. This saves money as well as time and effort. while being way more ecologically beneficial. If you do add mulch, take a note from nature and choose leaf mulch rather than wood or river rock or, God forbid, landscape fabric. Leaf mulch will decompose and add nutrients to the soil. Other materials are harmful to plantings as they can prevent airflow, they can impact water flow, and, I mean, in general, they just make life harder for your plants to grow through this layer of mulch. Remember that soil is filled with living microorganisms. Consider how the choices you make can either harm or benefit the health of your soil, and healthy soil is essential for healthy gardens.
That is really great information and really great advice. So now, what about maintenance and cleanup? We've got a good start, right? But I know when some people think about native plants, maybe they've seen those plants growing naturally in the wild. And in a society like ours that's accustomed to manicured turf lawns, maybe they're worried or their neighbors are worried about things looking a little out of control and wild next door with those plantings. And then, oh, there goes the neighborhood. What are your thoughts?
So just as we consider our neighbors in planning and designing and species selection, we also want to consider them when we're thinking about maintenance and cleanup. But we also have to balance the needs of wildlife with what the neighbors like to see.
Oh, all right. Well, tell us more about that. What can we do?
So you can become an ambassador for gardening with native plants by maintaining a tidy garden while also understanding what wildlife needs. You may need to consider extra steps in maintaining your yard to keep a tidy, intentional yard that doesn't scare people away from native gardens. Strategically incorporate wildlife-friendly maintenance techniques along with cleanup that is solely for human interest. So for example, you can cut back sections that are closer to your walking paths and layer some mulch in there so there's a tidy space by the walkway, but perhaps leave messier, quote-unquote, messier sections in the back. The goal is to show intention and to slowly warm people up to the idea of native gardening by incorporating things they're used to seeing in a front yard, like mulch. So these cutbacks can be done strategically as well. You can leave plant material standing in strategic manners, such as in the back of the bed, or leave a mass of coneflowers winding around. Winter gardens are beautiful. Picture masses of grass with the black seed heads of coneflowers winding around. Design and plant choices are critical and can help lessen the need for cleanup when you create a garden for all seasons. Just as we mimic nature with design choices, we can take cues from nature for maintenance, but also play around with your maintenance choices to suit your unique needs. Learn and pay attention to the cycles of nature, which is an opportunity for a personal connection with nature too.
That's really fascinating. And I wanted to hit on two points that you mentioned. The first one is you were talking about how the winter interest of gardens and how these plants form these different seed heads. And I do think that that's really important to point out because I know that in my experience with the school groups that we have come around, our learners love nothing more than to go out into the prairie and look at all the different types of seeds and explore those different kinds of seeds. So it really does add a lot of interest. And the second thing is that this idea of keeping things nice and tidy up front while letting it be maybe a little unruly in other spaces, less visible to the neighbors. I'm thinking we should call that a mullet garden, right? Because it's business in the front and it's party in the back. But I'm also thinking of this idea as its own smaller habitat quilt within the larger community habitat quilt of interconnected landscapes that we've talked about last time as being a goal. So the idea is that there are still, let's say, less manicured patches of the yard, the party in the back part, where insects have free rein to do as they please, but maybe those are a little more screened from view in order to keep the neighbors happy while hopefully sparking interest for them and luring them into native gardening. And as you said, showing that you're being intentional about the design would surely help in that regard. What are some other things people might not think of when taking wildlife needs into consideration? What are some small things we can do that have a really big impact?
So first off, I love that analogy about mullets. That's perfect. Yes, definitely. You can leave some wild areas in your yard. For example, logs, they can be great nesting habitat for bees and other insects. Piles of debris like leaf litter and logs and sticks, they can provide small critters with this protection from predators, and it acts as these corridors so that they can travel safely. Create soft landings under trees. So soft landings are a really interesting topic. You're essentially planting a matrix of diverse ground covers under the drip line of a tree. This provides shelter for insects that wrap themselves up in a leaf cocoon and they fall to the ground for overwintering. So I like to imagine your typical yard where underneath the tree there's just lawn or maybe there's some mulch. Imagine a pollinator wrapping itself up inside a leaf to overwinter, and then when they fall to the ground, they fall to mulch or just lawn. They're not protected at all. So these soft landings really help to provide that habitat for them to overwinter in. Another thing you can do is leave those areas of bare sandy soil for ground nesting bees. And then when it comes to cleanup, maybe don't cut back your stems. Leave those hollow or pithy stems standing for the stem nesting insects.
Oh, that's a really great idea because, yeah, we know that we have a lot of native insects that do use those little stems to nest in, to overwinter in. And so that's those stems, those standing stems that we look at and we think, oh, those are just dead grasses or flowers. Those are really important to our pollinators as well. So those are great ideas. And you mentioned leaving logs, and I know you're so right about that. I'm always amazed when we have school groups and we take them out and we might roll a log to see just how many little creatures are using those logs to make homes underneath. And as a note for our listeners, it is fun to do this, but we're always very careful, and we're careful to roll the log back into place after making our observations so that we do disturb those little critters as little as possible. Now let's talk about those stems again for a moment, because I know people often cut back stems after the flowers bloom on plants. What are your thoughts on that from an ecological gardening perspective?
So rather than cut the flowers back after they bloom, leave them for the wildlife. That's a great way to attract birds to your yard as they eat the seeds. And then come winter, insects are looking for places to overwinter. And many species of bees nest in the stems of plants, creating these cavities either in hollow stems or by digging through the pith, depending on the plant. Leaving things standing through the winter is ideal. You can also opt to cut stems back in strategic ways, perhaps leaving things standing in masses but cleaning up around them. Pick which species to leave standing based on if they have strong stems that can withstand the elements and that won't break and fall. By spring, you may be itching to clean up your garden, but take into consideration the life cycle of insects when you do so. You can cut stems to 18 to 24 inches sometime around May. That's a good time. Leave these stems indefinitely, as some insects need years before they emerge. That new year's foliage will cover up the dead stem, so they're hidden and not an eyesore. I do recommend checking out this bee expert, Heather Holm. She has great guides for cleanup to support bees.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much for that. And we will drop a link to Heather Holm's website in the show notes to help guide our listeners. So this is something we can do in the spring to be mindful of the local insects, right? So we can leave our stems up, hopefully all winter long, and then just strategically cut back some in the spring, being mindful again, as Vivian noted, understanding your local insect residents and their life cycles. What about later in the year? What should we be doing to support our native insects in the fall?
One thing you can practice in the fall is leaving the leaves. You may have heard that phrase, but wondered what it means. It's a movement to encourage a change in the way we manage our yards. So every fall, on a strict schedule we made up ourselves, homeowners everywhere can be seen raking leaves into bags or burning the leaves, mulching them, etc., till every inch of the yard is leaf-free. It's just another example of those rules we have ingrained in ourselves as a necessity and the norm that an ecological gardener can evaluate for better alternatives. Like, we all love to see butterflies in our yards or enjoy a summer night dotted by little fireflies. Consideration needs to be taken for their life cycle if we wish to save these species. Many of us aren't aware that so many insects overwinter in leaf litter. Luna moths and fireflies are a couple of great examples of insects that rely on fallen leaves. They'll wrap themselves up in the leaves that fall from the trees, or they'll stay under the leaf debris and wait out the winter. Removing the leaves will kill these insects. The better alternative, then, is to leave the leaves. So how do we do this without our neighbors getting upset? We can tidy up walkways and other upfront areas. A good example, the Whitmire Wildflower Garden. We have formal areas where we are more traditional with our cleanup, especially around walkways. We'll pull the leaves back from the path. We'll mulch certain areas. We'll keep a design to our cleanup. If you have a lawn, you can rake the leaves into flower beds. I love creating designs with a border of leaves next to mulch, winding those two through a bed. It's a great idea to leave the leaves under trees and shrubs for the pollinators falling to overwinter. It is sort of funny that these practices are so outside the norm. They're seen as rebellious or wild. I do like to think that one day society will look back at all the lawn mowing and other normal practices that literally eliminate insects in our yards, and we'll just be astonished. Slowly but surely, we are making progress, for sure.
I think that's a great observation. I think it's an interesting phenomenon, the way we just accept generation after generation what we've been taught as far as how we maintain our home landscapes, what's acceptable, what they should look like, what our priorities are. And I really love what you said about using leaves and mulch to make designs through a bed. I like the idea of rethinking the way that we've done these things and maybe not just accepting what we've done as we learn more about the importance of pollinators and that they are in rapid decline. I think it's especially important that we turn ourselves maybe away from doing things just for the aesthetic reasons that, you know, we as humans have decided looks pretty, and start thinking about ourselves as part of these ecosystems that surround us. So there's hope, right? And one of the hopes that I have is that our listeners have found this series as valuable as I have. There's so much more to learn about this huge, huge topic. And we've talked about some resources for learning more about this subject. But I wanted to close out this final episode of our three-part series by featuring a really cool resource offered right here at the Nature Reserve. Our horticulture team here at the Nature Reserve offers a really great series of classes called the Native Plant School. And Vivian, I know you're very involved with those classes. In fact, the idea for this three-part series about ecological gardening 101 was born from a Native Plant School class you facilitated. Maybe you could describe what the Native Plant School is.
Yeah, so the Native Plant School is great. It's a year-round series of classes taught by us, the horticulture team at Shaw Nature Reserve. These classes cover various aspects of native landscaping and are supported by our partners at the Missouri Department of Conservation and the St. Louis Wild Ones.
Awesome. And these are monthly classes, right? So I know the Native Plant School classes are very popular, and those classes often fill to capacity very quickly. So for listeners who try to register for Native Plant School classes but find they're full, what other learning resources are there out there available to them?
Yeah, so there's Shaw Nature Reserve's guidebooks are excellent. You can find those online. Grow Native is another great organization. They have a great website for design recommendations, any tips on cleanups, everything that we've discussed. There's a lot of great books out there on native landscaping. I highly recommend Bring Nature Home by Doug Talmy. And then, of course, you can visit our wildflower market. It's the first week of May. It's so much fun. So not only do we have a lot of food and beverage vendors there, artisans selling their crafts, we also have plant vendors there as well, so you can show up and buy plants for your yard. But then you can also pre-order plants from Shaw Nature Reserve. And if you're lucky, you might get a milkweed that was grown by the horticulture team.
Nice. And as always, I will put links to as many resources as I can in the show notes for you, our listeners. Okay, I think that just about wraps up this final episode of our three-part series, which means we are saying goodbye to Vivian for now. Considering the time of year, I'm sure she has more than enough on her plate to keep her busy, so I can't keep her with us any longer. Thank you, Vivian, for coming on and helping us understand more about ecological gardening. You've been so helpful. I feel like I have a better understanding of how to design a beautiful native garden and keep it going. Thank you so much for being with us, and happy growing season.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, I always appreciate an opportunity to ramble about native gardening and share some of my experience.
Okay, listeners, I really hope you enjoyed this three-part series all about ecological gardening. I know I learned a lot more about how I can do more to support my local wildlife in my own backyard. Here's what else is happening at Shaw Nature Reserve this spring. First, spring and summer class registration is open. Go online to browse the catalog and sign up. Don't forget to check our show notes, our social media, and our website for more information. And it's almost time for the big spring wildflower market. By now, you've got a good foundation of knowledge, and it's time to make some decisions. Here's all the information you need to come and get your plants right here at the Shaw Nature Reserve Spring Wildflower Market. First, the online presale opens April 10th at 9 a.m. at snrshop.org. This is your opportunity to snag some plants grown by our very own horticulture staff. Then, The wildflower market itself takes place Friday, May 3rd, and Saturday, May 4th. However, please note that Friday the 3rd is reserved for members of the Missouri Botanical Garden. Membership has benefits all year long, so if you would like some of those benefits, it's easy to sign up to be a member online. Now, I know that's a lot of detail, so you can go online, visit us on our social media or our website, and clarify any questions you have. Folks, I've had an amazing time bringing a piece of this great nature reserve to you. Thank you so much for joining us here at All for Nature. From all of us at the Nature Reserve to you, thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the trails.